This is Carol Bond, returning with the Decatur Herald and Review, the second part, and this issue is dated May 26th. We'll begin this reading today with the obituaries. Larry Leon Cuttill, 75, of Decatur, passed away on Sunday, May 24th. In Heartland Manor Care of Decatur. Memorial services to celebrate Larry's life will be 6 p.m. Thursday, May 28th at East Park Baptist Church, 1919 South Baltimore Avenue, Decatur. Memorials are suggested to the Children's Miracle Network or East Park Baptist Church. Graceland Fairlawn Funeral Home, Decatur, is in charge of arrangements. Paul Edward Robinson, 42, of Decatur, passed away on Saturday, May 23rd, at Decatur Memorial Hospital. Services celebrating his life will be 11 a.m. Saturday, May 30th, at Walker Funeral Service, with visitation 1 hour before service. Professional services entrusted to Walker Funeral Service. Carl Woodrow Woody Willoughby, 92, of Lovington, died at 2:27 a.m. Friday, May 22nd, at the Arthur Home. Funeral services will be held at 10 a.m. Saturday, May 30th, at Schrader Funeral Home, 431 South Vine Street, Arthur. Burial will follow in the Arthur Cemetery. Visitation will be held from 5 to 8 p.m. Friday at the funeral home. We find one more article related to education, and this one is headlined, She's Still Contributing. It was written by Alex McNamee, H&R staff writer, and the dateline is Forsyth. Brenna Fink probably never thought she'd put to use her 3 years of high school Spanish so soon, but it's made her transition from player to mini coach a little easier. Since tearing her ACL before the season, Fink was set on making as big an impact from the dugout as she would have on the field during her senior year. She'd be the best player's coach anyone could ask for. A Division I softball signee to Murray State with 3 going on 4 years of varsity experience. And she could relate to her teammates better than any of the adults, well, because she's their age. Try to be a mini coach, she said with a big smile and laugh, holding out her arm next to her as to mock just how mini she could be, a reference to her own 5'4" stature. Her bubbly personality makes her all the more relatable as a coach. It's also why she was so fun to play with the last 3 years. Her being at practice makes the mood better, said Bailey Martin, who has been Fink's running partner since they were 7 years old. Her being there makes girls want to push because they know Brenna and they know what she expects. Being a player's coach means relating to everyone, especially the freshman replacing her, as Maroa Forsythe's shortstop, Danaid Santini. Fink already knew Santini from basketball season, so she knew what it was like to talk to her. Danaid and her sister Lidanis primarily speak Spanish, so Fink's years of learning the language academically have come in handy, kind of. So I've tried to put some of that to use, but it was a little different than their Spanish, Fink said. Now they know a lot more English than they did before. It was a struggle, not gonna lie. Santini brought some natural ability to the table right away. She has a feel for the sport and is a smart base runner, which are two of Fink's best traits when healthy. The freshman showed some of it Saturday against Monticello when she scored after a pitch in the dirt got past the catcher. Moroa teammates said coaches have seen Santini get better with Fink's instruction, and although the language barrier makes details harder to get across, it has gotten easier. Brenna's done a fantastic job showing her, hey, this is where you should be. Hey, you should be doing this. Come in 2 steps, Moroa head coach Phil Appleby said. And then you can see the gears turning and Brenna will be like, this is why you need to go there. And she will be like, oh, okay. Santini made a couple of plays that wowed Fink on Saturday. She almost created an unassisted double play in the 7th inning, snatching a fast ground ball up the middle, going to her left, stepping on second as the base runner barreled in and throwing a dart to first across her body. Fink called it one of the best plays she's ever seen attempted, even though the runner was called safe. Santini also made a good play, turning an unorthodox 3-4-6-5 double play on a sacrifice bunt attempt, an infield situation which Appleby said the team simulates in practice. Just another lesson from Fink on how to handle it. I can't say our shortstop would be the same if Brenna wasn't there, Martin said. With Fink's help, Moroa filled a big hole at shortstop. It's one less thing Appleby has to worry about as the Trojans move forward into the Downs Tri-Valley sectional semifinals against St. Joseph Ogden Wednesday. He likes his middle infield as much as he did when Martin and Fink were running the show the last few years. It's one asset better now, with Martin leading by example, a promising freshman on the field, and the brains of the operation coaching from the dugout. But make no mistake about it, Appleby would have loved to see his all-area pair have one last hurrah before they head to separate Division I programs, Martin to Indiana State. Having a coach like Brenna, I'd like to see her on the field, obviously, but she's still contributing, Appleby said. This is the ending to their high school careers. They thought they were going to write together on the field, but from the beginning of the season, they had to get used to seeing each other differently around the diamond. It was different, Fink said. When I was at therapy, Bailey would be like, oh, are you coming to the game? You coming to practice? And I'm like, I can't. I have therapy. And she's like, what? You can't do that. So it's been hard. As far as what's happening on the field, Martin's trying to do enough for both of them. Although they're not turning double plays together, they lifted the regional championship trophy together for the first time since they were freshmen. Those memories couldn't be more different. That team was 25-0 before losing in the sectional championship. This team wasn't guaranteed anything after Fink got injured, but Martin never gave up. Fink found a way to make her mark, and together they reached their dream ending. That's simply good enough. Basically, my motivation is for her, Martin said. Everything I do is for Brenna and for the team. Knowing she can't play gives me a confidence boost that I can do it for Brenna because I know she enjoys it just as much as I do. We'll turn now to an editorial, and the headline is Espionage Case Doesn't Get Media Attention. A case more than 10 years in the making finally came to an end Former Milliken student and CIA agent Jeffrey Sterling was convicted of violating the Espionage Act in January and sentenced to 42 months in prison on May 11th. Sterling graduated from Milliken University with a political science degree in 1989. Afterwards, he attended Washington University School of Law, graduating as a Juris Doctor. Sterling was convicted of leaking secrets about Operation Merlin, a plan designed to provide Iran with flawed nuclear plans to stunt the growth of their nuclear capabilities. However, after the leak, many believe that the operation would have advanced their nuclear capabilities since the flaws were so minor. Sterling used appropriate channels and approached the Senate's Oversight Committee, but nothing happened. As soon as there was a leak, all eyes were on Sterling. Since the conviction, the prosecution constantly and aggressively pushed for the maximum sentence of 19 to 24 years, claiming that Sterling acted as a disgruntled and malicious ex-employee. The defense encouraged the courts to recall similar cases of much more severe leaks, like David Petraeus, who was tapped on the wrist with a fine and 2 years of probation. Sterling's circumstances could be much worse, but they're not great. Sterling is the only alleged whistleblower to deny a plea bargain. John Kirikou and David Petraeus immediately admitted to leaking, and their confessions signed their plea bargains. Their leaks were more severe than Sterling's. Information marked as top secret or the names of covert officers. But Sterling's silence was enough to prove his guilt. From the start, Sterling was guilty until proven innocent. The prosecution's tactics during Sterling's trial were questionable. They retroactively classified evidence, declassified previously classified documents, and provided anonymous testimonies to force the case into its jurisdiction. There's a good chance that this case could have closed about 10 years ago. According to the Washington Post, U.S. District Judge Leonie Brinkema said Sterling deserved a harsher sentencing since he denies any wrongdoing. It's a mystery, then, if this case could have been closed with a plea bargain, or if it was intentionally dragged out to show the prosecution's capabilities. Life as a marked traitor isn't necessarily the lap of luxury. Regardless of what could have been, Sterling claims innocence, but is still going to prison. Dr. Scott Lambert, a professor of journalism at Milliken University, believes this case has presented controversy in journalism and a necessary debate about the judicial system. If you think Sterling is innocent, the sentence is unfair, Dr. Lambert said. If he was guilty, it puts him in line with the others. I sit back and think this will be good for him in one way. In 3 years, he can start to build a life as a convicted felon, but even that should be easier than what he's lived for the last decade. Perhaps one of the most appalling aspects of this case is the incredible lack of mainstream media participation and coverage. Unlike Politico, bloggers like Marcy Wheeler and other third-party sources, no major media outlet picked up this story. Mainstream media was eating up the controversy with James Risen and reporter's privilege, but nobody touched Sterling's story until after his indictment and conviction. Coverage of the trial was abysmal in quantity and quality. Norman Solomon, director of the Institute for Public Accuracy, said in an interview with Millikan students in Dr. Lambert's Journalism and First Amendment Law course. Leading up to that trial, there was a brief report from the Justice Department correspondent on National Public Radio, but even in that, there were several mistakes. NPR never sent someone to cover the trial. You could count the number of media outlets who sent reporters on two hands and have fingers left over. Solomon also told Millikan students in Dr. Lambert's class that the profile of the James Risen case ebbed and slowed, but media interest from editors plummeted as soon as Risen was no longer involved with the case. The Sterling case does have a significant impact on the worlds surrounding it of whistleblowing and journalistic privileges. Now that the trial is over, of course, mainstream sources will happily report the story as a victory for the American judicial system. A quick trip to Google will show posts from CNN, the New York Times, and other major news outlets briefly covering the case and reciting the sentencing. But if anyone were looking for this story months or even weeks ago, they would not have found many stories about Sterling. Luckily, Marcy Wheeler, an avid blogger, follows all of these types of issues that we may not hear about, and she has a serious talent for collecting public documents. Perhaps it's time for the mainstream media to take notice of these third-party bloggers and journalists and take a few examples. Otherwise, Solomon's statement that people will know more about Lady Gaga than important people in our current historical context will come true, and society will be truly blinded to the actions of the government created to serve them. This guest opinion was written by Tyler McLean, a Millikan University student. This has been Carol Bond with the Decatur Herald and Review issue dated May 26th. I look forward to reading with you again. Another Decatur Herald and Review columnist submits this article, Veteran Forced into Shameful Choice. Before he tried marijuana, he thought of trying suicide. Heavy drinking hadn't helped, nor had various pills prescribed by Veterans Affairs doctors. He was still angry, still depressed, still could not sleep. But he found that marijuana helped. It took the anger and depression away. It took the sleeplessness away. Most of all, it took the 11-year-old boy away. PFC Jared Hunter never knew the boy's name. He was just some Iraqi kid who liked to hang around the army base outside Baghdad. He didn't really speak English or nothing. He would just kind of follow us around, would point things out, or tell us if there was somebody there who shouldn't have been. The soldiers adopted him as a mascot. Hunter bought him a soccer ball. The boy was with the soldiers when they came under fire while patrolling an alley. When the shooting was over, he was dead. If combat does nothing else, it hardens you to indiscriminate death. You just learn to deal with it, says Hunter. Something like that happens at that time, you just walk on past it and forget about it. Of course, later on, he adds softly, it may come up a little bit or something somewhere. It came up with a vengeance on Hunter. He's a 30-year-old Arkansas native living near Daytona Beach who joined the Army in 2003 right out of high school and served two tours. He was discharged with a diagnosis of post-traumatic stress disorder, a neat clinical term for night terrors, heart palpitations, rage, and the seductive lure of suicide. Hunter was almost seduced. He says he was sitting there with gun in hand when his father found him. Finally, a friend suggested something he had never tried, marijuana. He says pot worked like magic. It calmed the anxiety. I wasn't having near as many anger problems. The suicide stuff went away. I didn't really feel that desperate to do anything like that again. I've got a bad back and a bad neck. It relieved any kind of pain that I had. It just helped so tremendously that it was unbelievable. Marijuana had saved him. Then last year, police came to his door. He still has no idea who tipped them off. They arrested him and confiscated marijuana plants he said he was growing for his own use. Hunter found himself facing 5 years in prison. Prosecutors offered a deal: plead guilty and accept probation. He refused. He didn't want to be branded a criminal and stripped of his civil rights. But last week he accepted a new offer. It requires him to pay court costs and costs of prosecution amounting to less than $1,000. His record will show not a conviction, but a withhold of adjudication, a judicial get-out-of-jail-free card that leaves his civil rights intact. One is glad Hunter's legal travails have come to such a favorable end, but who's to say the next person in his position will be as fortunate? More to the point, we should be appalled this sort of thing is even possible. That a veteran can be threatened with prison because he used the only effective treatment for a wound incurred in the service of his country. Hunter is thinking seriously of moving to Colorado or some other marijuana-friendly state. The problem, he says, is that cold weather causes his physical wounds intense pain. In effect, then, he is required to decide between the well-being of his body and that of his mind. That's a shameful choice to impose on a man who damaged both body and mind fighting for his country and for, you know, freedom. Let's see what question is being asked of Dr. Roach today. Dear Dr. Roach, I am 73 years old and I consume a glass or two of Merlot wine with dinner each day. What, if any, problem exists with sulfites present in this wine? His answer is this: sulfites are used as preservatives in many foods, including most wines. A dry red wine like Merlot typically has about 50 parts per million sulfites, which is about the limit of detection for people with sensitive noses. Some wines can contain as much as 350 ppm. White wines and sweeter wines tend to have higher sulfite concentrations. In contrast, there are foods with much higher sulfite concentrations. For example, certain dried apricots have 1,000 parts per million or more of sulfites. Some people have reaction to sulfites. About 5% of people with asthma are sensitive to sulfites. The most common reactions are skin-related, such as a rash or itchy skin without a rash, gastrointestinal, such as diarrhea and abdominal cramping, and respiratory, including wheezing and cough. A very few people experience anaphylaxis, a life-threatening reaction including collapse of the circulatory system that requires immediate attention. If you haven't had any problems with your wine, you likely have no reaction to sulfites. If you have enjoyed dry fruits without problems, you almost certainly don't have sulfite sensitivity. If you did have a sulfite sensitivity, you would need to avoid sulfite-containing foods and look for organically grown wines without added sulfites. Even though some sulfites are naturally present in wine, they are at a low enough concentration that they may not cause problems. People with severe reactions to sulfites, like anaphylaxis, probably shouldn't have wine again, but that is a discussion to have individually with your allergists or other doctor. Another question asks about blood pressure and age. Dear Dr. Roach, should your blood pressure go higher as you age? Is the top number or the bottom more important? I don't like medicine, and my blood pressure was 145 over 82, but the top number sometimes goes to 150 to 158. And he answers, both the systolic, the top number, and diastolic blood pressures are important, and the difference between them is occasionally important. For example, a blood pressure of 160 over 60 is more worrisome than 160 over 85. Blood pressure does go up with age, but even in people older than 60, the recommendation is still to get the BP down below 150, and I try to aim for 140 if there aren't too many side effects. It often takes several tries to find a regimen that gets the blood pressure where it should be without affecting quality of life. And here's a letter to Dear Abby. Dear Abby, my wife and I are in our 50s and have legal custody of 3 of our grandchildren who are between the ages of 3 and 8 years old. We've been raising them since birth. My wife is nearing the end of her battle with cancer. My family, my mother, siblings, and son keep asking me what I'm going to do when my wife passes away. They say they know people who would adopt the children. I don't wish to be nasty, but I need to let them know that I am able to take care of my grandchildren. Can you please tell me how to tell my family that I can raise my grandchildren without hurting their feelings like they have hurt mine when they mention adoption? Signed, Hurt Grandfather in Pennsylvania. Dear Hurt, yes, the words to use are, when you say that to me, it hurts me deeply, so please don't say it again. I will raise these children just as I always have, and I do not plan to ever turn them over to strangers. Period. Expressing it this way is not hurtful. It clarifies your feelings.